Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, in a moment, Time Magazine's Michael Ware from Baghdad on the role of militias in Iraq. They're far more powerful than the country's military. But first, Enron's former CEO Jeffrey Skilling may take the witness stand this week in the fraud and conspiracy trial of Skilling and Enron founder Ken Lay, who will soon follow Skilling to the witness chair. Defense lawyers will try to counter the prosecution claim that the two men knew about financial problems inside the failed energy giant, but at the same time gave outsiders false comfort just before Enron careened into bankruptcy in December of 2001. Mary Flood is covering the trial for the Houston Chronicle. She joins us from the federal courthouse in Houston. Mary, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, and some legal experts you spoke to say the government has a strong case. They told you that lawyers for Skilling and Lay will have to hit a grand slam to avoid conviction for their clients. Why?
The experts I called, and this is everybody I called, defense lawyers, prosecutors, and some academics, said that the government proved a broader and a deeper case than they expected. And even though it wasn't document-heavy, and even though it depended on a lot of people who have pleaded guilty, they all told such interwoven stories that it was just much stronger than anyone expected, which means that Lay and Skilling, the jury knows that they're educated guys, that they're men of the world, that they have to stand up and save themselves now.
Well, but it's funny, you just raised the question of my next question, which is the fact that many of the government's witnesses did plead guilty. And so does that tarnish them at all?
Of course it does. And some of them, like the former CFO, Andrew Fasto, he was an absolute scoundrel. He involved his children by having, the filthy Luger written in checks off to his kids. He involved his wife and wouldn't plead out until after she wound up having to plead out herself and serving a year in prison. And of course the jury's going to look at these guys and think, what a bunch of liars. However, they all sat on the stand and said, the government has told me if I don't tell the truth, I can go to prison longer. So they have to weigh all this. The thing is, there were so many of them. There were nearly a dozen of them who had something that the government could give them. But they all told similar stories, and not identical the way they, as if they planned it. Mm. But they were similar enough, and there were enough of them, and they were repetitive enough that I think that there's a really good chance that the jury took some of it seriously.
As you say, they were interwoven. Well, Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling are expected to testify. When? And who's going to go first?
Skilling's going first, and he could be on the stand as early as Wednesday or Thursday of this week. The defense is going to put on a lot of very short witnesses before we hear from Skilling, and then Lay will be after him, and then they'll probably put on a few experts. We could be out of this defense case in about a month, and this could go to the jury.
Who might the experts be? Who's likely to testify on their behalf?
The experts are going to be really boring accounting and business people, and they're going to back up the contention that Lay and Skilling have that this was generally business as usual. This was a company that was doing okay, but because of the crisis that came up when people found out Andy Fasto was literally stealing, there was a run on the bank. And these are going to be business experts, accountants, to say that this is possible.
And by the way, remind us of the charges facing Lay and Skilling, because some of them have been dropped. So what are they facing?
Skilling still faces 28 charges. He's got conspiracy, a bunch of security frauds, some false statements to auditors, and several insider trading. Lay, in this trial, still faces 6 charges: conspiracy, wire fraud, and security fraud. But remember that Mr. Lay still has a second trial to go through. He's got 4 personal banking charges that are going to be tried to the judge right after the jury goes out in this case.
Well, and when you say things like conspiracy, as you write in one of your articles, the verdict in this case may come down to what both men were thinking at the time of their alleged crimes. And the definition of intent is going to be key when the judge gives the jury the final instructions before deliberations. This gets really complicated, but can you kind of watercolor this for us?
The jury has to decide what Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling knew, and of course that's in their minds, and what they intended. Did they intend to deceive? That's in their minds too. But the way you figure out what's in somebody's mind is from their acts. And so they've heard all sorts of evidence about people saying they told them things from which they can infer that they knew it, and that they said things and they can look at the order. So it's a lot of circumstantial evidence that the jury has to put together. And as some experts said, when a jury's trying to discern intent, sometimes it's little things like a nod or a chuckle that shows you that the person knew and intended to do wrong.
And what are some of the instructions that the judge can give?
The government's going out on a bit of a limb, and they're asking for something that some people call the ostrich instruction, which is that these guys deliberately didn't pay attention. They saw smoke all over the place, never looked for the fire, even though they had a duty to do it. And the defense is going to argue that what these guys knew is what their capable subordinates and professionals told them. And all that was in their mind was that they were told there was no fire by people who should know.
We mentioned there were going to be some experts, but there's also going to be a parade of character witnesses. Who might they be?
Well, for Skilling's using some, you know, sort of ordinary citizens, but Lay's list includes a lot of big preachers here, the owner of the Astros, former mayor, and a local bishop.
How are people, you know, in the diners and the cafeterias or whatever you have there in Houston, how are the, you know, what's the talk about the trial?
What we found is that people are obsessed with the trial, and I think it's because of something we've done here, and that is the blog. Because we've got a blog that is going real time, and we're putting something up every 15 minutes to a half an hour, people can follow this like a soap opera, and they are. And all my friends who were bored and, like, I could clear a room about Enron up until this trial, now that people can tune in any time, we find that they're fascinated by it. And I think the obsession needs to stop. They're crazy about it. Every time I go to a party, I don't realize it, but I'm going to be the feature speaker because people want to know so much about this trial.
Mary Flood, covering the Enron trial for the Houston Chronicle. And when might it stop, Mary?
It might stop in about mid-May.
Mary, speaking to us from the federal courthouse in Houston. Mary, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw are in Baghdad today, urging Iraqi leaders to form a government in order to put a stop to the sectarian violence that threatens to engulf the country. Last month, nearly eight times as many Iraqis died in execution-style sectarian killings as did in terrorist bombings by insurgents, according to new U.S. military statistics. Military experts blame much of this violence on the actions of Shiite militias that began targeting Sunnis in the wake of the February 22nd bombing of the Shiite mosque in Samarra. Well, we want to spend some time today on the role of militias in Iraq, and it's a complicated one. Time magazine reporter Michael Ware is in Baghdad. He joins us now. And Michael, you spent time with Iraqis in both Sunni and Shiite militia groups, in particular with members of the Shia Mahdi Army. Remind us, who are they, and why are militias in general important?
Essentially, to have a seat at the political table here in Iraq, to have a stake in the game, you by and large need to have an armed militia. I mean, the president of this country has the largest, most sophisticated militia in the country. The Mehdi Army is just another one of these. This is the army of impoverished Iraqi Shia who answer to the radical rebel anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. So these are his foot soldiers who fight both the American troops and any other enemies that the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr identifies.
A lot of our listeners will remember the black-clad members of the Mahdi army in the battle for Fallujah, but we understand now these followers of Muqtada al-Sadr have their own T-shirts?
Oh, look, they've had uniforms and garb since the beginning. I mean, their signature dress is all black. I mean, that has a particular religious or sectarian resonance for them. So that's an immediate identifier. There's been other forms of dress that they've employed. But what I noticed most recently, and which came to the surprise of U.S. military commanders for Baghdad, was that when I was recently within their stronghold in eastern Baghdad, I saw them in uniforms, clearly marked in Arabic, of course, Mehdi Army Protection Committee, 2nd Brigade. I mean, for what's supposed to be an illegal, outlawed rebel militia, that seemed pretty brazen.
Well, tell us more about Syed Salah. This is the mid-ranking commander from the Mahdi Army. What kind of, you know, how is he viewed in his community?
Oh, he is a treasured part of it. I mean, the quarter of Sadr City, which is essentially a festering, sprawling slum or ghetto for Shiites in Baghdad, which was neglected and oppressed during Saddam's regime. Sewage literally flows in the streets in this part of Baghdad, where the U.S. military estimates 2.5 to 3 million people live. Now, Saeed Salah's area of responsibility is part of the area where he lives. So he's a part of that community. Everyone knows where he is. In fact, within the Mehdi army, certainly within the units I've been dealing with lately, their leaders aren't known as commanders or the boss or officers or holding a particular rank. They're known as the servants. So Saeed Salah, for example, is the servant of a number of checkpoints and militia positions within his broader name.
We're speaking to Michael Ware of Time Magazine. He's in Baghdad. He's speaking to us about Saeed Salah, just one of the many leaders of the Mahdi army that he has been speaking with. And we should say we're speaking to you on your cell phone. We're very grateful to be able to talk to you, but sometimes it goes in and out, and I'm sure our listeners won't mind because what you're saying is so fascinating, you know, about the role that many of these Mahdi army members play in their towns, you know, literally running their own checkpoints and running at will through checkpoints that are manned by the Iraqi army. You asked a lot of these commanders from both Shiite and Sunni militias how they felt about so many of the killings that we're hearing of recently, and they're blaming these killings on what they call rogue elements.
What we have here is the mainstream of the insurgency and the militia forces. I mean, these are vast bulk of the people fighting the American military and seeking political power here. Now, these people, by and large, identify as freedom fighters, nationalists, or those pursuing very identifiable political interests. On the vast extremes of both sides are radical religious elements. And the mainstream of the fighting organizations, both Sunni and Shia, blame the extremists for trying to drag the rest of them into a bloody sectarian civil war, which these men say they don't want, which is not in their interest, and which would distract from the main game, which is fighting the one common enemy that they all identify, the poor American soldier.
Michael Ware is a reporter for Time Magazine in Baghdad. His article, "Can Iraq's Militias Be Tamed?" appeared in this week's Time Magazine. Well, can they? We'll be back to find out what answer Michael Ware came up with. Much more coming up here and now. We're talking with Michael Ware. He's reporter for Time Magazine in Baghdad. He recently interviewed several members of the Sunni and Shiite militias now operating in Iraq. We want to continue this conversation. And Michael, we've been talking about how these militias have rogue elements, fringe death squads that have been fighting each other. But you say that the mainstream members have a common enemy, or feel they do, the U.S. occupier. And you say that they're now working together to find new ways and new weapons to go after U.S. soldiers?
Oh, look, U.S. military intelligence will tell you that. I mean, we saw years ago bomb-making signatures from Western Iraq, from Sunni strongholds, showing up in these Shia strongholds within the capital. Now, you can imagine when you make a roadside bomb, a hidden explosive device, which targets American vehicles, the way a person puts that together tells you a lot about who taught him, his level of sophistication. There's certain signifiers which can lead you back. Now, we started to see Sunni insurgent bombs showing up in these Shia strongholds, and vice versa. We've seen last year a very lethal type of bomb, which was introduced through radical Shia militia groups organized by Iran and its military forces, who have been trained, some of whom were sent to Lebanon, where Hezbollah taught them to make this particularly deadly device, and they brought it back to Iraq. In time, we watched this type of bomb migrate from south to north and eventually cross over into Sunni areas. So the technology or know-how was passed on.
Right. And shared. And so, as you say, they say this is not yet a civil war, but it's a more brutal war, not just because of things like this bomb, but because of these, what they call renegade death squads almost.
Well, look, these death squads are operating wholesale. They roam unchecked. Now, on the Sunni side, they are from the extremist groups of Al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, other Islamic militant groups such as Ansar al-Sunnah or Ansar al-Islam. There's also Baathist or nationalist assassination teams running around, but largely they're targeting people that they deem to be collaborators or spies and so forth. On the other side, there are Shia death squads also. Some of these are from the broader groups such as the Mehdi Army, but others are in government uniforms. Some of them are police officers by day and death squads by night, because you need to understand that the Ministry of Interior, for example, has been captured and is owned by an Iranian-backed militia. So most of the people in its uniforms answer to the militia. Some of them take their uniforms off at night and become death squads. A lot of these people taken by the Shia death squads are taken when official government identification is shown. It's just that these people then, when they're arrested, never show up at any police station, at any prison, at any detention facility, and instead their dead bodies appear on a street a day later.
We're speaking again with Time Magazine's Michael Ware in Baghdad on his cell phone, so the sound may be a little rough, but what you're saying comes through loud and clear, Michael Ware, which is that this is a pretty brutal situation. And first of all, do you think Iraqi leaders are going to be able to choose a new prime minister? Do you think that will happen? And do you think that one move will change the situation on the ground?
Well, one way or the other, the Iraqis will settle upon their prime ministerial candidate, be it the current interim prime minister, Ibrahim al-Jafri, or be it another preferred candidate. Either way, it's not going to matter. Both of them are beholden to the militias. Both the current prime minister and the alternative candidates are all linked to Iran and to the Iranian-backed militias. None of them have any incentive whatsoever in pulling apart the militias, which, by and large, serve their interests.
Actually, that leads to just another question just we want to get to quickly, which is that might it lead to even more violence in that we understand that those jockeying for position are also Shiite, as is the current prime minister, and there's some concern that they might turn on each other.
Oh, absolutely. We already see intra-militia rivalry, both on the Sunni side and on the Shia side. Indeed, for example, if the current interim prime minister, Ibrahim al-Jafri, is ousted from power, then I would imagine that the Mehdi army militia of the rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr will be none too impressed. They've put all their political eggs in the Jafri basket. Should he be sidelined, so will they politically. They have been the kingmakers who have kept him in this position. If he loses out, so do they. And what will they do? Will they take to the streets? Will they re-escalate their war against U.S. forces? That's an enormously grave and serious risk.
So, Michael Ware, in just the minute or so we have left, what's the solution? It sounds like the militias are the problem. What's the solution?
Well, there's no quick fix, I'm afraid. Nothing is going to be easy here, and everything is going to be bloody, no matter which way you go. You have at least three wars underway here right at the moment. You have the terrorist war of Al-Qaeda and its acolytes fighting a global war, holy war, or jihad, of which Iraq is just one. And they're the ones behind the suicide bombings. You have an insurgent guerrilla war, which is getting forces and trying to drive out the occupation. No more, no less. And the third layer of conflict in this country is the sectarian violence, what some are already calling undeclared or low-boil civil war. I mean, we are already seeing between 25 and 60 bodies showing up every day as a result of this kind of violence, depending on whose figures you use. So there's really three kinds of conflict being played out here at once, and there's no easy solution to any one of them.
Michael Ware, reporter for Time Magazine, speaking to us from Baghdad on his cell phone. And again, sorry, we had some sound difficulties, Michael, but what you say with such clarity and passion. So we heard you loud and clear. His article, "Can Iraq's Militias Be Tamed?" appears in this week's Time Magazine. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my great pleasure. Take care.
Stay with us. There is much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from Now. The U.S. Supreme Court decided today not to hear the case of Jose Padilla. Padilla is the American citizen who was arrested at Chicago's O'Hare Airport in 2002 and accused of plotting to detonate a so-called radiological dirty bomb. He was kept in a military brig, called an enemy combatant, and never charged with a crime until late last year, when the Bush administration changed its legal strategy and transferred him to a criminal court, charging him with being part of a terror cell waging jihad outside of the U.S. Well, joining us now on the line from Washington is Lyle Denniston, longtime Supreme Court correspondent. He writes online for SCOTUS blog. And Lyle, we want to be clear. Jose Padilla, as we said, was charged late last year, but that's separate. So what was his case before the Supreme Court today?
This is the prior case that he had been pursuing for several years, challenging President Bush's detention of him in a military brig in Charleston, South Carolina for nearly 4 years.
Right.
And this was a continuing challenge to that status.
And as we just said, late last year, the Bush administration did change its legal strategy on the eve of Padilla's Supreme Court arguments then and transferred Padilla to criminal court on conspiracy charges. The Bush administration was criticized at the time for doing that.
Yes, the administration actually has been criticized quite severely by a lower federal appeals court for what that court felt was an attempt to manipulate the courts by shifting Padilla's status on the very eve of the pursuit of the case in the Supreme Court against his former status.
Right. Well, today the justices had a divided response to Padilla's case against his challenge to his former designation as an enemy combatant. How did the vote split today?
Well, it was actually, Robin, split 3-3-3. Three of the justices said the court should hear the case and decide whether or not the president did have the authority to seize Padilla and put him in a military brig. Three other justices said, well, we're not in favor of review, but we want to explain why the court is not doing it. That's clearly the most important of the three opinions. And then there was a third block, two opinions. There's a third block of justices who simply voted not to hear the case and didn't say anything. That's Justices Alito, Scalia, and Thomas. They didn't say anything, but clearly they voted against review. So there's a 3-3-3 split.
And we need four votes to hear a case. Well, tell us about one of those opinions. Justice Kennedy wrote it, and it was for his decision to reject the case.
Yes, it's a very interesting opinion. It kind of straddles a number of issues, and in fact, it kind of straddles the ideological divide because it attracted the support of John Roberts, the conservative Chief Justice, but it also attracted the support of one of the court's liberal, perhaps most liberal member, Justice John Paul Stevens. And Kennedy's opinion, I think, reached across that ideological gulf because it says a number of things that are favorable to Padilla and potentially helpful to him in the future if the government should try to shift his status again. It also says some things that are impliedly critical of the government, and it warns all the courts to be alert that as this case unfolds further, they should be careful to protect Padilla's rights should his status change once more.
So, Lyle Denniston, you know, who won and who lost today?
Well, I think probably it is a decision in favor of the government in the sense that And the most recent lower court ruling upheld the president's power to do what the government did to Jose Padilla. That decision is still on the books and was not wiped out today. The issue is still an open one as to whether or not the president does have the power to seize an American on American soil and hold them as an enemy combatant. That's not resolved. However, Padilla was not left empty-handed. He got a number of comments from three of the justices of the court in what I think is the most important opinion, number of comments that say the courts in the future should be careful to look after his rights if the government shifts its strategy toward him again. The court also implied that it was somewhat skeptical about the government's claims that the courts essentially had no role in this. So people like Padilla could walk away from this claiming something, though perhaps not quite as much of a victory on their side as it was for the government.
Well, you said there were some hints, though. Are there any hints about the court's view of presidential powers in wartime?
Well, I think there's one line in the Kennedy opinion that says that Padilla's case raises fundamental issues about the separation of powers. That's a kind of a code phrase that says we want to be sure that the president is not exercising his wartime powers in such a way that shuts out the court's role in looking after civil liberties. These are kind of coded phrases, but sophisticated observers of the court understand that what the court is saying here is, be careful, Mr. President, we're on watch here as to how far you're going to go with these claims of wartime power.
Well,
so I think that was really significant.
Well, Lyle Dennison, what happens now to Jose Padilla and his case?
Well, in September, as of now, the schedule is, he is to go on trial in Miami federal court on charges, as you pointed out at the opening, of conspiracy to aid terrorism overseas. The charges are not as serious as the ones that the government had often said that they thought Padilla could be charged with, though he was never charged with them, like releasing a radioactive bomb in this country or blowing up apartment buildings with natural gas explosions. Mm-hmm. But he does go on trial now, and if he is convicted, then presumably he'll get a significant prison sentence. If he's not convicted, then the government at that point might have the option of again declaring him an enemy combatant and throwing him back into the military brig.
Right. And Lyle Dennison, just your thoughts about Jose Padilla, the man, who's been sort of a ping-pong ball in this. We feel as if we keep seeing him go from court to court. Is that usual in a case like this?
No, I think this case, Robin, stands out. The unfortunate thing is that we don't really know much about Jose Padilla as a human being. The government has repeatedly and publicly sought to portray him as the worst of the worst, but because he has been held incommunicado for so long and for so long without access to anybody outside his jailers, we don't know anything about him as a human being. But we do know that the government has used his case in various ways, perhaps not entirely and intentionally to manipulate the courts, but they've used his case to try to escape repeatedly a judgment about the validity of the president's actions. And that's somewhat unusual, and I think it causes a good deal of tension in the courts watching the government do that with a particular American citizen.
Correspondent Lyle Dennison, he writes online for SCOTUSblog.com and helps us understand all things Supreme Court. Lyle, thanks so much.
Glad to be with you, Robert.
And still to come, two Harvard professors are looking for friends and colleagues of Leonard Bernstein before the opportunity to learn more about a young Lenny is lost. Rocket in my pocket. I love that song. You're listening to Here and Now.
Cool boy, don't get hot, 'cause man, you got some high times ahead. Take it slow, and daddy-o, you can live it up and die in.
Well, it's a big day in sports. It's opening day for most Major League Baseball teams, including our own hometown Boston Red Sox. President Bush is in Ohio today, throwing out the ceremonial first pitch before the Cincinnati Reds' home opener against the Chicago Cubs. And the NCAA Men's College Basketball Championship game will be played tonight in Indianapolis, with Florida meeting UCLA. So, seems like a good time to get a dollop of sports. Dave Kindred is contributing writer for the Sporting News. He joins us from Indianapolis, where he's covering the men's Final Four. Dave, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thank you.
And the game tonight, the UCLA Bruins against the Florida Gators. Are a lot of people winning the office pools? Because I'm thinking, you know, in this tournament, a number 11 seed, George Mason, made the Final Four, you know, busting up everyone's bracket. So did anyone win?
Well, somebody's going to win, but it's not going to be anybody that I know.
It's not me.
UCLA and Florida, of course, are familiar names, but no one really expected them to be good in this tournament. So to have them playing a championship game is something of a surprise.
Yeah, and before we talk about the game itself, do you think this is the wave of the future for college basketball, men's and women's? You know, so many Cinderella teams.
No, it's not. It's a nice thing. It's an aberration. You know, George Mason, for instance, happens once every 25 years, so we shouldn't be holding our breath for the next unknown to get here. The women's Final Four, I think three of those teams are from the ACC, so it's a familiar territory there, too.
Right.
Cinderella is always nice, but Cinderella happens only once in a while.
That's right, and then it's just the whole pumpkin thing happens. Okay,
I'm afraid so. We've
spoken here about Yannick Noah, the tennis player's son, who's playing for Florida. Tell us, you know, maybe more about him and about what else we should look for in tonight's match between the Gators and the Bruins.
Well, Joakim, as they pronounce his name, Joakim Noah, is a fascinating, cosmopolitan kind of citizen of the world guy. You know, the son of Yannick Noah, the French tennis pro, and a former Miss Sweden, I think, who grew up basically during the summers, at least, living in New York, playing on New York City playgrounds, where he became a basketball player. He's 6'11". Yesterday, he said that he was asked if he had ever played tennis. He said, "I gave it up after 2 days." You know, so I think that tennis was never in his future, but basketball is, because he wanted to make his own name, and he's doing that now. He still has a ways to go to be a good professional player, so I imagine he'll still be at Florida next year at least, but he's come a long way in this tournament.
Any standouts for the Bruins, or is it a team effort? What should we look for?
It's an atypical UCLA team for those of us who grew accustomed to the John Wooden, fast-breaking, beautifully offensive-minded teams. To me, that's what basketball is. You know, and UCLA now plays, you know, a kind of suffocating iron defense. And while purists, basketball coaches, et cetera, may like it, it produces often a game that is not very interesting to watch. And I think that's the kind of game that we're going to be due tonight. Oh. It'll be hotly contested, and it will be a fiercely fought game, but it's liable to be, you know, like 60-59, which will be interesting,
yeah.
But it's not 95-94, which is more interesting to me.
Well, we want to make sure, we want to take a look at baseball as well. As we said, opening day for most, except for one game played last night, the defending World Series champs, the Chicago White Sox, beat the Cleveland Indians. Is there thinking that they can repeat?
Yes, they've improved themselves over the year. They've lost no one of any importance. They've added Jim Thome, who last night hit a home run. They've added a good pitcher in Vasquez. You know, they're going to be a very good team, and they've got something to prove this year. You know, I mean, last year they were seen as something of a fluke, you know, outside of Chicago, certainly. But there's no fluke there. They were a very good team, very solid team. Very well managed by Ozzie Guillen, and they're going to be very good again.
Well, of course, here in Boston, we're watching the Red Sox opener in Texas today. The Red Sox taking on the Blue Jays, I believe? Rangers. See,
yeah.
I'm watching it very closely. No, but I will be. Dave Kindred writes for the Sporting News. He's also author of the new book, Sound and Fury, The Parallel Lives and Fateful Friendship of Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell. We'd love to have you back to talk about that, Dave.
I would love to do it, Robin. Thank you.
Thank you. More ahead, here and now. We'll be right back. Leonard Bernstein was the first American to be appointed music director of a major American orchestra. He was also the first American to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic, the London Symphony, and to conduct at La Scala. But he was also just a guy from Lawrence, Massachusetts, as his friend Sid Raymond recalls.
I remember standing on a street corner with him when he was first accepted to Harvard. And we were standing there, and I said, "Gee, Lenny, you're going to Harvard." And he said, "Yes." He said, "And I'm going to develop a Harvard accent." And he did.
And 75 years later, two Harvard music professors are working with students to paint a complete portrait of Leonard Bernstein, one of the 20th century's most exuberant composers and champions of American music. Class at Harvard focuses on the artist as a young man growing up near Boston long before he brought classical music to popular audiences, most famously in West Side Story on Broadway and in film and television. Carol Oja and Kay Kaufman Chalamet are professors of music at Harvard University, and they join us now in the studio to talk more about their class. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And we understand, Kay, we'll start with you. We understand that as part of painting this portrait, you speak with people who knew Leonard Bernstein.
Absolutely. And it's a very important part of our project because we are very near the end of the window for actually being able to talk with people who knew him. Bernstein was born in 1918, so we're pushing the envelope on human memory and human life.
And the idea to get their thoughts while
Absolutely.
You can.
Absolutely, yes, indeed.
Well, let's listen more to Sid Raymond, who is now 87. We heard of them standing together on a street corner when Leonard Bernstein was accepted to Harvard, but tell us more about them.
Well, Sid Raymond and Leonard Bernstein have a remarkable story. They met around age 12 when they were both students at William Lloyd Garrison Elementary School in Roxbury and remained friends until the end of Leonard's life in 1990. Midway through all of that, Sid Raymond became an orchestrator for West Side Story. So it's exceptional in having this childhood connection that has this pretty famous, illustrious realization in adulthood.
Right. But as you're trying to do, it had its beginnings in simple things like buying sheet music. Here, Sam remembers being with Bernstein when his father gave him the money to buy music for George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue.
It was $2. And we both went into Hammermeyer or some store like that, and he bought it. And we went back to Lenny's place, and at sight, he started to play it. Because he was, as you know, a prodigious sight reader. Read anything immediately. Then he got to a certain part, and he said, "You know, I wonder why Gershwin wrote in this key." And he started to play it in another key. And now that was the first reading.
Gershwin was a composer who was very important to Bernstein. He played a lot of Gershwin, and he wrote about Gershwin in his senior thesis at Harvard. When he was a camp counselor during his teenage years, he put on some Gershwin shows. He knew the tunes inside and out. He went to the Pops a lot where Gershwin was being performed. He listened to the radio. Gershwin was in the air, and Bernstein was just soaking it up.
And you have some here. What is this performance?
This performance is Leonard Bernstein at the piano and conducting the New York Philharmonic. This is the adult Leonard Bernstein, the man who had risen to prominence, taking this childhood treasure and bringing it to the public.
We know that Leonard Bernstein had a complicated relationship with his father. Bernstein's father said in The New Yorker in 1958, "Every genius had a handicap. Beethoven was deaf. Chopin had tuberculosis. Someday the books will say, Leonard Bernstein had a father." Tell us more about that relationship.
It was fraught. It was also very close. His father was an immigrant from the Ukraine, a profoundly devout Jew who was involved with Temple Mishkan Tefillah.
That's here in the Boston area.
In the Boston area, a crucial member of that congregation, someone who kept his religious ethic, his values intact, and reportedly was something of a disciplinarian and sort of an austere, distant man.
Kay Kaufman Chalamet, why is it important to know these things about Leonard Bernstein?
Because we need to know where Bernstein came from. We need to know the forces that shaped his life, that his father was a devout Jew. This shaped Bernstein's sensibilities, his politics, his whole way of being in the world. We recently had a historian in to visit our class, Jonathan Sarna from Brandeis, who made the comment, if Leonard Bernstein had been born anywhere but Boston, or if he'd been born, let's say, in Cincinnati, he would not have been Leonard Bernstein.
Really?
So family is huge. Community is huge. Place is very important in who this man became.
Well, it's also fun to think, again, and we have listeners across the country who are thinking, huh, we think we could have produced a Leonard Bernstein, but it's nice to think of him as having been here. And we are reminded of that. Harold Shapiro was a friend when they were both undergrads at Harvard. And imagine Leonard Bernstein being one of the people who played along to movies at Harvard's Sanders Theater. Let's listen.
They were famous films like Potemkin, and they had us playing the piano along with them to make a soundtrack. And I did it for a while, and Lenny did it a lot. But when Lenny did it, it was terrific. I have to admit, my Potemkin was lousy compared to his, and he worked in all kinds of Russian folk songs, and Petrushka was in there, and it was great.
As we listen, I realize, Carol Ocha, that you're doing once again what Leonard Bernstein was so well known for. You're bringing him and, as a result, classical music to young people. He, of course, launched the award-winning Young People's Concerts with the New York Philharmonic. I mean, it's hard again to explain how big and hip and mainstream a personality he was. You know, is this a part of it to remind people that there was a time when this was so accessible to everyone, not just some listeners?
There was a charisma to this man that we're witnessing through the words of every single person who comes into our class to talk about him. This is someone who captured people's imaginations, who galvanized them, who was a born teacher, who was a born leader from the very beginning. And ultimately, through the Philharmonic, through his work on Broadway, became a star in a way that very few do. So it's that star quality I think you're talking about now,
yeah,
that we miss today. And we don't have a star of that magnitude who reaches into living rooms on network television and speaks to kids who are playing with their toys on the floor.
Yeah. We're talking to Kay Kaufman Chalamet and Carol Ocha, professors of music at Harvard University, where they have a class sort of trying to watercolor the full picture of conductor Leonard Bernstein. Thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
And we'll leave you today with some of Leonard Bernstein's Young People's Concert with the New York Philharmonic from January 1958. The episode is called What is American Music?
We might call that the kindergarten period of American music. Our composers then were like happy, innocent little kids in kindergarten. For instance, we had a very fine composer named George W. Chadwick. And he wrote very expert music and also deeply felt music. But you can almost not tell it apart from the music of Brahms and Wagner and other Europeans, like this overture of his. Listen.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now. To find out more about the Boston and Bernstein class or to share your memories of Bernstein's Boston years, visit our website, here-now.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us